Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guests are painter and sculptor George Rhodes and his sister, writer Emily Rhodes Johnson. George Rhodes was educated at the University of Chicago and the Chicago Art Institute. Not only an internationally known painter and sculptor, he is also one of the first American origami masters. His large audio-kinetic sculptures can be seen in airports, science museums, hospitals, and shopping malls all over the world, including the Los Angeles International Airport, New York's Port Authority, and the Golden Mall in Israel. His paintings are in many collections, including the Museum of Modern Art in New York and the Art Institute of Chicago. Emily Rhodes Johnson is a writer, editor, and teacher, and author of three young adult novels, Spring and the Shadow Man, A House Full of Strangers, and Write Me If You Dare. She also recently published a book about her brother. It's called Wizard at Work, The Life and Art of George Rhodes, published by Dog Ear Publishing. And I welcome you both to the show. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Now, Emily, I want to start with you. You say in the introduction to this book about your brother that you wanted to learn more about what went on in your brother's head and how he came up with all these amazing creations. Did writing this book help you clarify?
Well, it did help me. I'll never know what goes on in his head. But when I was young, I used to wish that he had a little window in his head so that I could see inside, because he was always making inventions and drawing wonderful pictures. And I thought what fun it would be to see what was going on and how that all was created.
And so did you interview him, actually, and act like you were not part of the family to try to glean some new information out of him?
Yes, I did. We had fun talking about early childhood memories and family stories, but mostly I relied on his letters that he wrote me all my life, really, from the different places where he lived.
Wow, that must have been an interesting exploration. George, I'm always curious when someone finds their passion so early in life. Do you remember what was going through your head when you started drawing at the age of two or three?
I just enjoyed drawing. I that's all that went through my head.
Really? Do you remember if you were trying to express thoughts or emotions, or do you know?
No, I was just trying to draw things.
I remember that you drew horses for, you know, a period.
I made an attempt at horses. Horses were difficult for me, so I studied them quite a lot. I still don't have a good grip on horses.
And you're still trying to master that, huh?
Well, not really. I've given up. But drawing is my thing, or was.
And according to your book, Emily, George became obsessed with kites and clocks as well early in life. It always seems to me that somebody who would be interested in that kind of thing would go into engineering or science or something. Well, how did you translate that into art, that love of clocks and kites?
Well, I didn't translate it into art. It was an interest of mine. Uh-huh. And I did go to engineering school in the Army, but not voluntarily. So I could have been an engineer, maybe, but I finally decided on painting.
I remember how his interest in clocks and watches interested me, too, as a child, because he had so many parts in his room and a whole drawer full of little wheels and gizmos, and he would pick up clocks that weren't working anymore, take them apart, and build new ones.
That is amazing. So were you taking clocks and watches apart to find out how they worked or to create new things out of them?
Just to find out how they worked. There's only one instance that I remember of putting a clock to work. I turned an alarm clock into a pendulum clock.
Wow.
With a few different adjustments that I won't describe, but that was one thing I did.
Emily, did George bring you into all of his schemes when he was coming up with some of these ideas and inventions?
Well, once in a while. The one I describe in the book.
Tell us about that one. That was great.
Well, our great-grandfather was a doctor at the time of the Civil War, and we had some of his implements in a collection. And George had a box. It was a wooden box, and I had never seen it before. But he took out these two metal cylinders attached to wires and asked me to hold one in each hand. Being the compliant younger sister that I was, I said, sure, I'll do that. And then he proceeded to turn a crank that turned some kind of motor inside and actually electrified the metal cylinders, so that suddenly I nearly jumped out of my skin.
So he was shocking you.
It was a doctor's shocking machine that he used as treatment for patients way back in the 1800s.
So, George, what were you thinking? What were you trying to invent? Do you remember?
Well, I invented several things when I was younger. A Ferris wheel was one thing. That was okay, except it was a two-person Ferris wheel. And if you tried to get out at the bottom, the top person would suddenly come down.
So, and did.
And did, yeah. So it was a little tricky.
So can you explain what was going on in your head, though, when you were coming? Did you see things in life that you wanted to come home and recreate in your own way? How did you come up with these ideas?
I don't know. They just popped into my head.
Really?
Probably as a result of seeing something and having it cook in my brain for a while.
Uh-huh. Because I remember my brother used to always build these big forts in the yard, and his reason was because he wanted to hide from our parents, you know?
Yeah.
So I was thinking, was there any functional reason why you would invent some of these things? But it was just toys always for you, right? And fun.
Yeah, just fun.
Well, I remember you told me that the Boy Scout handbook inspired you to make certain things.
That's
too.
Right, yeah.
That does tell you how to make things, right? For survival and stuff?
Well, yeah, but not only that. It's a good book. I recommend it. It tells you how to build a boat, make a camp, pitch tents, so on.
Uh-huh.
It's a good book.
And so would you make some of those inventions and then add elaborate additions to them from your imagination?
No, I didn't do that so much. The book was just inspiring as to what you could do and how you do it.
And then from there, your imagination just went wild from that book. You know, I have read through that book, and it's really quite inspiring. It still has so much information that we can use in the 21st century. You weren't, according to Emily's book, that interested in college, and you decided not to pursue a career in medicine or whatever your parents had in mind. Do you remember, was that difficult for you to defy your parents in so many ways?
Yes, it was. My father wanted me to be a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't take to that idea, but he was all right with my being an artist. He didn't like it, I don't think. He didn't complain too much.
You never entertained the idea of going into medicine, though, because it sounds like you were sort of interested in some of the aspects. I mean, you could have invented diagnostic tools or something, you know?
Well, maybe, yeah. But part of it was looking forward to medical school and all that education. I didn't want that.
Yeah. You had a hard time being a conformist, according to Emily's book, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So you were always an eccentric. Do you remember thinking that George was kind of an eccentric and strange to you, or did you get sucked into his schemes and think it was just great fun?
Well, yes. I think mostly it was just great fun. I mean, I didn't even know the word eccentric when I was young or what that meant. I just knew he was a lot of fun to be around, always joking, playing tricks on us, you know, very witty in speech, and just keeping things lively at home all the time.
Uh-huh. Well, one of the big turning points in your life seems to be when you moved to France, right? I mean, you moved to France as a young man instead of going to college.
Well, it wasn't instead of, but yeah, I did go to France.
Uh-huh. And tell us about that experience. Did it change your whole life or your vision as an artist?
Well, no, it didn't. But still, I did realize that I could be an artist, because artists are more respected in France than they are in this country.
Yeah.
And
you went in the 1950s, right, during sort of the heyday.
Yeah. Those were the years when Paris was still an art center,
mm-hmm.
kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It since has become not that.
Yeah, yeah.
That spirit was left then.
Were you influenced by some of the artists that you saw? I mean, you probably were exposed to things you'd never seen, like at the Louvre and the Impressionists. And
well, I was, but I'd seen those things before
uh-huh.
in books.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't influenced artistically so much as I was encouraged to be an artist as a career.
Did you learn how to speak French and actually fit into the culture?
Somewhat, yeah.
Uh-huh.
My son lives in France now.
Really?
So whenever I go there, I learn a little more French.
Uh-huh. And what kind of art were you creating when you were in France? Were you experimenting, or had you come up with some of the ideas that we know you for now? Or were you mainly just painting?
I was painting, and mostly landscapes, as I do now.
And living in a little studio, like living the life of the expatriate American in those days?
I guess so, yeah.
He used to write you letters all the time, right, from his travels. Can you talk to us about some of the letters that he wrote you?
I was in high school at the time and was taking French, so he would write letters in French, which was really great.
So your French must have been pretty good.
Oh, it was very good. And, of course, he always drew pictures to include in the letters and would tell me about conversations that he had sitting in cafes and the people he would meet, funny little things that happened. And, of course, his origami, too. That's when that started. And occasionally he would fold a little creature for me and slip it in the envelope. But that's when his interest in origami started, when he met Gershman.
Yeah, tell us about that. Had you thought about origami before you met him? Or
no. He was a writer, an eccentric. He was interested in origami.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed me some models made by Yoshizawa, who was then the great Japanese origamist.
Mm-hmm.
And I love those. Yoshizawa, to make four-legged animals, he had to use two pieces of paper. So my challenge was to make a four-legged animal out of one piece of paper, which I succeeded in doing.
Yeah.
And so I invented a new kind of base for origami.
God, that's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. How much hit and miss did you have to take you years to do that, or did you figure it out in a few months?
A few months, yeah.
And what was the animal? What was the animal that you created?
Well, I created an elephant with four legs, of course, and a trunk, two ears, two tusks, and a tail.
And you showed it to somebody at that point? Did they believe you did it with one sheet of paper, and then you to show them?
And
you were able to do it over and over again, huh?
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. So, have you gotten interested in some of this stuff because of George? How did you segue into becoming a writer? I'm curious about that too.
My two sisters were both artists, and I tried. George was always very encouraging. I still remember drawing a picture of fruit in kindergarten, and he praised that picture, and he hung it up over his bed. But I knew after a while that I was not an artist the way some others in my family were.
Uh-huh.
And maybe my writing was partly so that I would have something special that was creative of my own.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote lots of poems and little stories when I was young. And always liked to write, so and that was, and he always encouraged me in that way too.
So you come from a whole family of artists, right? Is everybody an artist?
No.
Now?
No. Our mother was an interior decorator.
But that's an art.
It is.
Yeah.
And she had a wonderful eye for color and design, and our father really did not. You know, he didn't understand art, but over the years, he began to understand and appreciate it. I think he was mostly worried that George wouldn't be able to make a living and support a family. But he really did come to respect and appreciate George's art.
Mm-hmm. And your father was a doctor, right?
Yes, he was a doctor.
Uh-huh. Well, that's great that he could come in and appreciate your art. That's an amazing thing if somebody can turn around like that.
He was quite traditional and, you know, conservative. And
And did you immediately start trying to sell some of your art? Did you sell some of it while you were in France? Was that how you started to make a living, by selling your paintings?
I still haven't made a living selling my paintings.
George Rhodes, we do not believe that.
No, that's true. I mean, I do. I have had shows in Ithaca and sold paintings, but it's not a living. Not yet. But I hope it will be before I die.
If you're just joining us, my guest is George Rhodes, the painter and sculptor, and his sister, Emily Rhodes Johnson, who wrote a book about him. It's called Wizard at Work, The Life and Art of George Rhodes. Now, we have to talk about your ball machines, which have fascinated so many people all over the world. How did those start coming about? Were you building structures and then putting stuff in them? Tell us how you started those.
Well, I started making small sculptures. I learned how to weld, so these were sculptures of welded steel. And I first used rolling balls as to impel pendulums to rock. So the ball would roll down and impel a pendulum, and then roll further down, impel another pendulum, and so on. That was the easiest way I saw to drive these pendulums in order, in series.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first ball machine. But then I began to wonder what else I could do with rolling balls. So I invented other devices that balls could operate. That was the start of it.
And that just came out of the blue, or had it been something you'd been thinking about?
No, it came out of the blue.
Really? And eventually you end up putting sound in it and use all, you know, you were using all kinds of things like cowbells and...
Right, yeah.
Were they becoming more elaborate because you kept thinking that you wanted to hear more sounds or see more action? Well, why did you end up making such big ones?
Well, to do a lot of different things, the ball needs room. So they naturally became bigger. But I wouldn't have done that if I hadn't had a commission early to do a big ball machine.
Uh-huh. Tell us about that first commission.
That was for the Port Authority in New York City. And it was a competition.
Ah.
But my mentor, who was David Bermant, who was a shopping mall magnate, he helped the process by putting one of my machines in the office of the people who were deciding what sculptures to buy, and that convinced them, I guess.
Oh, I can imagine why. They're so fun. They're perfect for a mall, right? In those early days?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
People in the bus station, I have watched them, and, you know, they can hardly...
take their eyes off of it, probably.
And they're rushing off to catch a bus, but even so, they just have to stop and see what this is, and see what's making all these sounds. So it's...
I think it's interesting that you use only gravity as the source of the energy for it. You never use any electronics, right?
Well, yeah. There's an electric motor that carries the balls up to the top.
Right. So it starts
That's
with an electric...
Energy.
Okay.
But then the energy of gravity does all the rest.
Wow. That's so amazing. Were you amazed when you started creating these? Did you get mesmerized by watching them, too?
Well, yeah, kind of, I did.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was fun.
And how did they end up in airports? Did you have somebody call you from the airport? Like, I know you have something in Los Angeles International Airport.
Well, we didn't advertise, ever. There were some attempts at it, but mostly it's word of mouth. So all the airports are connected. They know what each other is doing. So that's how the airport part got started, and also the shopping malls.
That's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
Do you go out and search for things like cowbells and xylophones and stuff for your works, or do you just look around the house and see what's there and use that?
Well, I search. There's a store in Ithaca that has many different sound devices and. Than others that I knew about.
Uh-huh.
So that came pretty easily.
Did you try to look for old stuff, old antique stuff?
Not necessarily.
Hmm.
Although when I did a piece for, where was it? That Steel Town. They had a lot of steel lying around, so I used some of that as chimes.
Hmm.
I like to use the things that are in place or in on the site where I'm going to have the piece.
Mm-hmm. And I know you have a lot of pieces in children's hospitals around the country. Yeah. Do you think differently when you create something for a space like that?
Well, not differently for the devices,
mm-hmm.
but...
For the themes.
The themes, they're always... More or less similar. They're simple.
Mm-hmm.
And my ideal is to create devices that are comprehensible, where you don't have to take anything apart or have anything hidden, so that everything in the piece is comprehensible to everybody,
mm-hmm.
just about.
Mm-hmm. And do you think in terms of the sounds for the children's hospitals, too, that are more cheerful or something kids would be attracted to?
Well, yeah. The sounds are cheerful anyway, I think.
Yeah, they are. They are, absolutely.
Happy sounds.
Yeah.
And the themes for the children's hospitals are circus, animals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A lot of animals, snakes, bears, monkeys,
Right.
Yeah, something to take kids off minds what they're having to go through, I would assume.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you come up with your titles? You also have these great titles for some of your works, like Odyssey of the Spheres, and one was called Lunatic.
Yeah.
I love those titles. Do you come up with the titles after the thing's complete?
Yes, as a rule. And that's the most difficult part.
Really?
Yeah. I ran out of titles. I'm always run out of titles, but then finally I get something. And sometimes friends provide a title. So I get through it somehow.
Did you find that an important aspect of your work, though, to come up with the right title?
Yeah. I mean, it's probably more of a challenge than I wanted to undertake, but I felt I had to do it that way.
Oh, that makes sense.
Many of the titles have the word ball in them, like Lollapalooza.
Yeah.
And Whatchamaballit.
So they're whimsical
yeah.
takes on what the whole creation is. Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's amazing. Have you ever given him a title, Emily?
I don't think so. No. No.
Uh-huh. Do you both have children that love playing with your inventions too? Did you turn your kids on to this kind of work?
Yeah, my son was interested, and he built some sculptures of his own.
Really?
Yeah, he actually put one in a museum. Or they didn't put it there, but they took it. I forget the name of the museum now, but...
Uh-huh. So is he an aspiring artist, or is he doing it for fun, or?
Well, he's a painter.
Really?
He lives in France.
Oh, he's actually a painter in France, huh? And
yeah.
He's making a living at it.
Well, kind of, yeah. he's a bit discouraged by the modern trends in art, which are, to me also, they're destructive and.
What? Give us an example of what you mean. Performance art, or
in painting, anyway. There's a trend. It's more than a trend. It's a preoccupation with ugliness, which I find rather disturbing and not at all helpful in any way to painting.
Yeah.
But some people seem to like it. I don't know.
Do you think a lot of people are trying to reflect what's happening in the culture? Because the culture has gotten quite violent and, you know, inhuman in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So art sometimes reflects.
Yeah, it reflects that. But why people would want those expressions in their home, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Some do, I know.
Did you feel like art should be an uplifting experience and take you away from the everyday drudges of...
Exactly.
Of existence.
Yeah.
You've always felt that way, huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, what about you, Emily? Do you feel that way about art, too? You must love art in so many ways.
Well, I do. I'm an appreciator, certainly. Mm-hmm. And I have many of George's paintings in my home.
Yeah. Your paintings are beautiful, by the way.
Thank you.
I was looking at your website. Yeah. So on that same track, I want to ask you this, too, because you seem like somebody who wants to have kind of a simple life, and I understand that you do yoga, and that's a big part of your life.
Yeah.
Are you attracted at all to this high-tech world where everybody's carrying around gadgets and talking on phones? You must find that so strange.
I do. Yeah. Especially doctors. I was turned off by my doctor, who spent all his time looking at charts and listening to devices. I don't know what, but it just was...
And so he wasn't interacting with you, huh?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I had an interview with a doctor recently who quit because of that.
Ah,
quit the profession because of it's going in that direction of being inhumane, you know?
Right.
Yeah. But I would think somebody like you who's, you know, you are attracted to little devices and balls and... You know, movement and sound, that you would be attracted to cell phones and iPods and machines, you know.
Well, yeah, I am. But these are machines that where the way they work, the actual mechanism is hidden and, in fact, incomprehensible to the public.
Uh-huh.
And we're in a phase now with these machines that nobody understands them. They need books to help them get through them, to understand them, and they still don't understand, and the people that make them don't seem to care to make them understood. So everyone is helping each other with computers and devices like that, which is good. You know, I need that instruction. Others do too.
Have you tried to take any of the modern devices apart and put them back together like a clock, figure out how they work?
No, because in electronics it doesn't work that way. If you take something apart, you've got something more mysterious than what you started with.
I believe that's probably true too. Talk to us a little bit more about how yoga changed your life, though. You started practicing it quite a long time ago. Was it a way to calm your mind and think, or how did you use it?
Well, I used it for self-realization and meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And
you taught it for a while.
I taught it, yeah.
Really? So you really became an expert at it, so to speak, right?
Well, if you can call it, it's not a matter of expertise, really. It's a matter of not thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something that you let happen. You can't make it happen, but you let it happen.
Uh-huh.
And I can't tell you the result because it's beyond words, but it was very important to me.
Yeah.
The realizations that I had during meditation.
Yeah. You say something in your book about George, and it was a quote, something about how you need to live in the moment so you don't have to worry about the past or the future. Is that what yoga has helped you to do?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And you don't think you'd be the artist that you are without it, huh?
Oh, maybe, but I'd have hang-ups of various kinds.
And I understand you still paint every day.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And are you painting creations that you're selling, or painting just for pleasure? Or?
Well, I paint whatever I think of,
uh-huh.
and it's mostly landscapes.
And do you actually have to go out into the landscape to paint it, or are you using photographs or just memory?
Memory mostly, sometimes photographs,
uh-huh.
but I have a good memory for landscape.
Yeah, I've seen some of your paintings. You seem to really be attracted to clouds.
Yeah, clouds.
Yeah, that seems like a meditative force for you in some ways. A lot of your paintings have gorgeous clouds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like to paint clouds.
That's great. Well, George Rhodes and Emily Rhodes Johnson, we have run out of time. I want to thank you both for joining us. And is there any contact information you can give people? Do you have a website, or either one of you, if you want to give information for people to get in touch to either get your book or, purchase one of
them? I have a website, yes.
Okay.
You can look under my name. You can look it up.
So georgerhodes.com, is that what it is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what about you, Emily?
I don't have a website. Dog Ear Publishing has a website for me. It's emilyrhodesjohnson.net.
Okay. Well, the name of the book is called Wizard at Work, The Life and Art of George Rhodes, and we thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.